Lightspeed Venture Partners presents Tomorrow Built Today. You can find details from this episode and more at tbtpodcast.com.
Hi, everybody. It's Jeremy Liu here from Lightspeed with the latest edition of our podcast. I'm here with Andy Dunn, good friend, former portfolio company CEO, now leading the effort at Walmart to drive new brands, owned and operated, a term that he coined, digitally native vertical brands, and building those out. So welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So Andy, you have had one of the most remarkable stories of entrepreneurship. You know, Bonobo started with you selling pants out of the trunk of your car.
I had a funny thought this morning, actually, walking up here, which is, as a founder, if you can just sell the first $1 million of product yourself through sheer force of will, it enables you to really prove your concept before you go out and raise capital. And I was thinking that the three ways that we did that were really direct selling ourselves, word of mouth, and then getting that beginning snowball of editorial PR. But the first part was probably the funniest, because my co-founder and I would walk around campus and graduate school carrying two Trader Joe's bags full of pants. And guys would be like dropping trousers behind trees and parked cars, trying on the product. And there was this emerging cult around the product that really was driven by us being, you know, direct sales reps for our brand. And then we threw our first pants party, which is probably a contrarian idea. And, you know, dozens of guys showed up. They would buy two or three pairs at a time. And that was the beginning of realizing, wait a second, maybe we have something here.
And I remember when you moved to New York, your apartment doubled as the warehouse and the showroom and the office for everything.
It did. We have, I think, something like 48 Bonobo Sky Shops now, which are these next generation fit to ship e-commerce showrooms. And it strikes me the first one was our apartment on 17th Street in Irving. And guys would just come by. They would hear about the brand and they would say, I want to try it on. And I would invite them over. And funnily enough, a lot of those guys became our early investors, because there was no institutional capital interest in a pants over the internet company. But these early customers who loved the brand would offer to invest. And that was part of how we stitched together our early, you know, angel and seed rounds.
Well, talk a little bit about that, because that was hard going in those early days. You had so many individuals investing because you didn't have the ability to raise institutional capital. The grit, the zeal, the belief, the vision that had to keep you going through those early days, and to inspire a team who didn't have that. This wasn't their company. This was a company that you and Brian Spaly founded. So talk a little bit about the importance of that as a leader in the beginning.
It was a crazy time. You know, I think from 2007 to 2010, when we did our first institutional round, we raised four different rounds, $8 million of capital from something like 140 people. And so you think about the number of conversations and the number of, you know, rubber chicken dinners that you have to get that many people conviction to write a check. And for people, it's meaningful, right? Even if it's a $10,000 investment, that may be a very big decision for someone. And so I love this concept that supply is infinite, which is, if you think about the world, there's so much supply of support, capital, talent. It's actually a massive well that you can draw from. And if you view it as inevitable that you're going to do it, then you can just go materialize that outcome. And so I'll see entrepreneurs now who are stuck, who need fundraising, who can't get it institutionally. And my message is just go find it, cobble it together. And there's a few tricks to doing it. You know, one is, rather than trying to find someone to lead a round, you effectively just price the round yourself. You figure out how much capital you want to raise. And then you kind of become agnostic about what the minimum is. You know, maybe you tell people it's $100,000, but anyone that will give you, you know, 10, you take. And then over the course of 6 months, you go from person to person, and they have two introductions for you, and then they have two introductions for you, next person. And so you end up with this massive number of people you talk to. And the way that I think about it is, you start to feel like the universe is conspiring to make you successful. You don't really know where you're going on the journey, but each new person that you meet is opening up new doors. And you'll get a lot of people that won't invest along the way, but over the course of 6 months, generally, you can pull $1 million together, which is frequently all you need to keep the company going for another three or six months. So it was a really difficult time, but in a lot of ways, it was a real magical time because of the quality of the people that I was meeting and the way that they were able to add value to the company as advisors and just and even enthusiastic customers who were spreading the word.
And I remember when I went to your wedding, at least half of the people who were there were these exact same people who believed in you in the beginning.
Yeah, maybe they were just coming because we were finally getting the capital back via the transaction that was happening at the same time. I don't know if they felt obliged to come, but a lot of incredible friendships, people who ended up coming into work at the company. You know, in a way, I don't regret that era of really bringing in whatever it is, 100 angel investors into the company. At the time, it felt pretty painful and pretty scary.
I also remember thinking that your wedding was such an Andy Dunn affair because it started at 10 p.m. and it finished at 4 a.m.
Yeah, I think we actually got married at midnight or something crazy like that. I thought maybe no one would stay afterwards, but the dance party was going till 4 a.m.
It was strong. It was strong. It strikes me that Peloton walked the same path that you did later on, an exact same challenge that, you know, by pioneering a new category in digitally native vertical brands at the time that you were doing it back in 07 through 2010 was a new category. They had to rely on customers as investors in the same way that you did. Mm-hmm. I remember when Ted Wang introduced us, I didn't even want to take a meeting. You know, I said, like, there's no way I'm going to invest in a men's pants business. Like, it doesn't make sense. It's not what we do. It's not, we're technology investors. Mm-hmm. And he said, just take the meeting. And I did. And when you and I met, it was just so clear that your vision was so much more than simply building a better pair of pants.
It's funny. I was thinking about that today. I remember being on the phone with you, was standing outside the Rosewood Hotel, sunny day, and being in a lot of ways so surprised that we finally got a term sheet for our company, and always grateful to you for, in your own right, being the pioneer of investing in these kinds of brands. But there's a good saying, pioneers get the arrows and settlers get the gold. You know, I was meeting some entrepreneurs last week as we embark on the strategy of doing a roll-up of the space. And they have had money thrown at them over the course of the first 2 years. The fundraising process has just been, you know, star-kissed. I remember thinking this is the opposite of what we went through. And then at the same time, you get to invent a category and also educate the investor community that this is a category worth backing. And so it's worthy work, but it's really stressful at the time. I think I probably had met something like 50 venture capitalists by the time we finally got a term sheet from Lightspeed, and I think we got to co-create the category together.
It's certainly a category today. You know, if you look at the list of companies that have built digitally native vertical brands, they are all these household names, whether it be a Casper or a Warbian. They're all following the footsteps of Bonobos. You know, one of the things that really struck me when I first met you is that you emphasized the importance of culture from the beginning, of company culture, of values, of what the company stood for. A lot of companies eventually come around to talking about the importance of culture and values, but in the case of Bonobos, it's been really core, and I think it's really influenced the composition of the team. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I think it actually starts from a place of failure. I can remember in 2010, having thought I was pretty good at hiring up until then and having a bunch of executives that then churned out of the business. And I didn't know what to do because the narrative that I had crafted for myself is that I was good at hiring people into the team. And as you know, when executives churn out of an early stage company, it's tremendously disruptive because it takes generally 6 months to find someone and 6 months to replace them. And when you only have 20 or 30 or 40 people and folks are seeing executives leaving, it's tremendously destabilizing. So I reached for a lifeline and I went and sat down with Mark Laurie, which is kind of funny because he's now my boss, the mm-hmm. founder of Jet. He was then the founding CEO of diapers and soap.com. And we went to lunch down the street on 6th Avenue somewhere at 6th Avenue and 14th Street. And I asked Mark, how do you hire people? And he said, someone told me this 3 years ago and I didn't believe them. And you probably aren't going to believe me today, but this is how you do it. He said, you take someone's experience and you make it third on the list. So the whole process of looking at someone's resume and thinking about their background and connecting their background professionally to what they need to do for you, just downgrade that to third. And instead, put first and second, fit with the company's culture and passion for the mission of the organization. And I was like, all right, that sounds good, but how do you actually do that? And he said, well, passion for the mission is easy to evaluate. You make someone two offers, one at a higher cash and a lower stock, and the other one at lower cash and higher stock. Then if they take the higher cash, lower stock offer, then simply walk away from the process. So that's passion for the mission. Someone voting that they don't care about title and they don't care about opening cash compensation that much because they're just so excited to get there. And he almost had like a flat offer for almost everyone he hired. It was $100,000, regardless of your experience. And that was how you got in the door because it was really about how excited you were to be there. And then fit, he said, the thing that most entrepreneurs get wrong about fit is they try to describe a culture that they wish they have rather than one that they actually have. And his view is that your first 10 employees define the culture, and that once you've got that culture in place, it doesn't really change. It's like a kernel of DNA, you know, in the birth of an organism, and everything spirals and unfolds from that opening DNA. And so he talked me through what those core values were of the people at diapers.com. And I remember a few of them, and I came back to Bonobos really energized, and I made a list of, at that point, the 30 people we had ever hired. And I took the top 10. And I said, what do these people have in common? And I ended up writing down a list of five things: self-awareness, empathy, positive energy, judgment, and intellectual honesty. And I got nerded out on it, and I created like a 1 to 5 scale, where for empathy, a 5 was a Jedi, right?
I remember this scale. I remember the interview forms that we had to like think about these people on different on these different dimensions.
Yeah, or a positive energy, a 1 was a fun sponge. You know, someone that actually takes energy from a room where they walk in. And there were descriptors around it. So for self-awareness, it was, can you talk about why you suck in a room with other people? You know, I call it admirably non-defensive. And we probably got too nerdy about it. We ended up kind of grading people on their personalities, which can actually be a little bit damaging to someone's psyche. So we walked back from being that specific. But what it did was it enabled us to have a framework around fit. Not only in terms of how to think about it when in the hiring process and the kinds of questions you need to ask both of the candidate and in references, both on list and more importantly off list, but then also to watch the way that that unfolds for an individual at the company and recognize when they're not a fit and being willing to fire on culture. And so over time, what you do is you reveal a crisper and crisper internal set of values that then replicate. So someone comes into the organization, if they're not a fit, it's almost like organ rejection. And we woke up probably 18 months later from that conversation with Mark, and we were named the 16th best place to work in New York City by Cranes. And in a lot of ways, that was probably my proudest day of our team and of our organization.
I think what you're talking about is really important, because a lot of people will talk about not a fit. Or even, you know, on a more positive example, is, hey, you know, we don't tolerate brilliant assholes. But it's really hard to make that something you can have a conversation about unless you have this sort of rubric and you're specific about it. Otherwise, it does run the risk of, I think in the technology industry, we have a systemic problem with, you know, underrepresented minorities and with women breaking into the industry. And oftentimes, you know, what people will say when they don't want to hire somebody is that they're quote unquote not a fit. But unless you have this sort of explicit rubric around it, it's hard to have a conversation about what that means.
It can actually be really dangerous, because what happens is that people can say someone's not a fit because they don't like that person.
Yeah.
And if you have a lot of different personalities at your company, not everyone is necessarily going to want to be friends with everyone. And if you're not careful, fit can come to become a thing that leads to homogeneity within the company. Mm-hmm. And what you actually want is a phenomenally diverse employee base and a very inclusive culture. And so, for example, for a trait like positive energy, we were really careful to say positive energy doesn't mean you're extroverted or introverted, right? It's not, you don't have to be fun. You just have to bring a positive spirit that adds to the overall goodwill at a company.
Right.
And so if you abstract away from this rather bland notion of people describing fit without having a framework and make it about admirable human characteristics that are, that can be universal, regardless of someone's background, their gender, their race, their sexuality, then you can build a much more inclusive environment that's actually a higher bar for people to meet than who do we want to be friends with,
right?
Which is actually a really bad way to build a company.
Right, right. And again, that all comes down to having an explicit framework and, you know, laying it out so that everybody can have a conversation using the same words to mean the same things. I think the other point that you made is important too, which is it's not what you aspire to, it's what you are. And having the sort of self-awareness about what the company is today.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one of the, I think, most difficult times for the company was that you did start this company with a co-founder, and eventually Brian Spaly, and eventually he ended up leaving the company. And that actually was quite a traumatic time for the company. Talk a little bit about how you dealt with that.
Yeah, it was really humbling. You know, Brian and I were great friends in graduate school, and we had this view that because of our friendship and the quality of the container that we built for open and honest communication, that we would be, you know, better than average as business partners. And the reality is that I think it was actually made harder by the fact that we were bringing a friendship into a business partnership. And certainly some people can make it work, but we now kind of open source our experience at Stanford and teach courses about what happened. And our view is that frequently friendships are either diminished or eviscerated by going into business partnerships. And our experience was that we just started to disagree a lot. And the company was thriving, but we were grinding to a halt in terms of the process of trying to get to alignment. Itself became a whole separate process to manage that was tremendously energy draining and time consuming. And so I think we woke up one day and we're operating a company that has momentum, but we don't really like going to work, which is complicated because founders thrive on contagious positive energy and teams need to pick up on that. And so if you have a partnership with a where the founders aren't enjoying what they do in the process of doing it, it's really problematic. And this all went down in that angel invested era in the company where we didn't have a strong board, where we didn't have meeting shareholders we could turn to. And so I turned to a then board member for an intervention dinner. And we got together at this dinner and it was two of our board members. It was me and Brian, and it was another guy who would later fact in the story who we'll talk about, Brian Wolf, who was a common friend of ours from business school, who would later become the CFO of the company. And I brought this issue to the table. It was really hard to share. I felt vulnerable in bringing it up. You know, it's the kind of thing that it's hard to talk about, you know, hey, we're not getting along with your board. And I thought a lot about how to do it. And I'll never forget what our board member said, because I thought it was so incredibly unhelpful. He goes, why don't the two of you go in a room together and try to work this out, and you know, don't come out until you've either figured it out or one of you has a black eye. And I thought, what a backwards view of masculinity, you know, for a comp name for a nonviolent matriarchal ape that is trying to chart the future of you know, what how human beings should organize. This is the dumbest advice.
And you mean the bonobo.
The right? Bonobo. This is just not the bonobo way that he's describing. And so, you know, Brian and I ended up having a number of conversations. We couldn't really figure out what to do. And then one day I just said to him, you know, would you be willing to step aside? It was interesting. It was a quick conversation. It was on a Saturday afternoon at the office. It was after 6 months of being, you know, pretty disconnected. And he got a little choked up and he just said, yeah, when? It was remarkable. I think the awareness that we both had that it wasn't working, and he showed tremendous grace and dignity in stepping aside from the company. And he went on to create another great company in Trunk Club, and probably in 4 years guided that company with extreme capital efficiency to a, you know, not that numbers are everything, but a $300 million plus exit with Nordstrom. And I woke up and one day and realized, oh my God, I think maybe the better entrepreneur left the company. You know, we can't go back and run the play if he had stayed and I had gone. But I'll always be grateful to him for the way that he handled that situation and made a bright future possible for both of us.
Well, I think highly of Brian. I have never sat on his board, but I'm pretty happy with the way you ran the company. So if that's anything. But you know, you mentioned Brian Wolf, and he did end up coming on board as CFO a few years later, and he then became sort of your thought partner. And then eventually he left the company as well.
Yeah, it was a very humbling realization the summer of 2014. So Brian Spaly left, I think, in 2009. I felt like I was sort of a partnerless sole operator for a couple of years after that, which is difficult because I do think you need a sounding board and you need someone who you can really talk about your fears at the company with. Ideally, some of those folks on the outside, which we can talk about later, but also on the inside, someone who knows the challenges. And so when I recruited Brian Wolf to join as CFO, and I can remember a conversation with you where you were like, well, what experience does he have that's relevant? Because he would have been McKinsey in a hedge fund. And I said, I just need someone really smart who I can build this company with. And Brian came on and Brian Wolfedison was phenomenal for 3 years and really helped us walk away from some stupid ideas I had about what the company could be rather than what it was, trying to morph it into a multi-brand platform when really we had to be focused on being one thing really well, which was a great internet-enabled menswear company. And I credit Brian Wolf with helping really push back against me in a way that I think only a friend could, and not being beholden to my perspective on things and being really willing to push back. And we got to a place where that pushback was so severe that it started to fracture our relationship. And Brian left 3 years after he had started. And that was the same summer as the Chunk Club deal was consummated. And I saw, wow, how successful Brian Spaly had been. And at the time, we needed about $50 million in capital to keep the company going. And we did 42 pitches and we went 0 for 42. And it was a tremendously humbling time for me, because I started to look at those two partnerships and say, wait a second, I now have been business partners with two Bryans, both phenomenal, you know, phenomenal human beings and business people. Both of those business partnerships were ultimately not successful. The friendships were strained. And I realized, oh my God, the problem is me. You know, the common thread in these two failed situations is me. And while it's convenient in life, I think, to externalize blame to other people, the right way to be ultimately is to internalize blame. And rather than looking outward for what's challenged about someone else, to look at yourself and realize you're very, very likely your own greatest enemy. And what is to be learned about that? And for me, it was what makes me unpartnerable. And it took some time to, and really my wife has helped me see the ways in which I struggle with listening to people, truly being willing to exchange their ideas for my own. And ultimately, you can't be successful as a leader unless you're really willing to draw others' ideas out and create an environment not where they're wondering how to get in edgewise, but actually where they feel really comfortable and safe sharing what they think. And you showing the wisdom and enlightenment over time to not be challenged by that, but to really be empowered by it, and to recognize that that's the secret to leadership, is unlocking the wisdom of a group rather than the pressure that you put on yourself as a founder to be the one leading going forward. That was a really tough summer to see our company failing, my co-founder's company having, you know, done so well, when there were a number of characteristics in my co-founder that I had thought were problematic, and then realizing, wait a second, maybe I was the problem in that partnership too.
So I've been watching the Winter Olympics for the last few weeks, and one of the things that has always struck me is that when they do the close-up as the athletes are waiting to see what the scores are or whatever, they're always standing there right next to their coach. You know, it's such a close partnership between these Olympic athletes and coaches, and, you know, it really just underscores to me that, you know, having a coach is not a remedial step. Like, the best people in the world can be made better by a coach. And a lot of the stuff that you talk about now, you've worked with a coach on. Do you want to talk a little bit about, you know, how that process works for you, and what do you get out of it?
Yeah, and so there's a guy named Kerry Sulkowitz, who I was introduced to by one of our angel investors years ago. And he just said, you got to meet him, he's amazing. And I sat down with Kerry, and Kerry's a former psychiatrist who now has gone into the business of being an advisor to leaders, to CEOs, to folks in government. And what I found from Kerry, including going through, you know, some of these dark times that I'm describing, is having a consigliere who can be objective, who exists outside of the organization, but is also in it from the vantage point of spending time not just with you but with your executives, and helping you see your blind spots, is at some points in time is everything, because you can't do it alone. And I think that sometimes founding CEOs, founders in general of organizations, put pressure on themselves to figure it out. But by definition, if you have blind spots, and we all do, they're blind spots for a reason. You need someone else to illuminate those blind spots for you. And while hopefully you have business partners and executives who can help you with that, ultimately they work for you. And like it or not, there's an element of self-preservation that comes with that. Whereas someone externally, and if we're fortunate in our personal lives, we have this in our spouses, in our families, people who tell you the truth, but they don't really have context because they're not in it and they're not trained in the interpersonal dynamics of leadership teams. And so Carrie, you know, one time pulled me aside, you know, as an example, and we had an executive at that point in time who I was having some challenges with. And he said, you know, this particular executive is not aligned. You know, it's not just that they don't respect you. It's that they're just out of step with the rest of the leadership team. And it was actually someone who I thought really loved the company and was a strong fit. And so it was so fascinating to have Carrie raise that issue. That executive ended up being someone who left the company. You know, we actually have a really friendly relationship now, but at that moment, the relationship was broken. So that was sort of one example of Carrie being helpful. Another one that surprised me is one day he sat me down for lunch and he said, you know, I think you should get married. And I remember being really surprised and kind of annoyed that he was raising that because it didn't seem like pragmatic business advice. And so I dug in a little bit and he said, you know, people who are partnered up at home tend to see themselves more clearly and become better leaders. And I think as a, you know, as a bachelor running around New York, you may be missing out on the opportunity to be learning about yourself in a relationship. And I thought that was really comical advice at the time. It was difficult to hear and accept. And now here I am many, many years later, probably a half decade later, and got married last May. And what I have discovered is that by being wholly uninterested in my opinion on things, my wife Manuela has helped me realize just how powerful, generous, and proactive listening ability is. And just stopping talking, which not necessarily the case with this podcast, but in dynamics, interpersonally, just stopping talking and making space for other people to talk and seeing what comes out of their mouths. And I think so frequently founders, because you have to magnetize, fill space, talk a lot, their ideas, recruiting a lot. Well, what would it mean to show up to a meeting and not really say anything? Maybe until the end and seeing what comes to the surface. And a lot of that, for me, has come from learning from Manuela. And so here you have a guy in Carrie, you know, advising me on my personal life, you know, being there as bulwark when going through difficult times. You know, I experienced some clinical depressions, you know, sometimes take medication for it. I've gone through some difficult times with that. And here's a former psychiatrist helping me with that, seeing dynamics more clearly on the executive team that I would never get from talking to people because just people are managing up. And I think it's invaluable. And I think it's almost, it should be a requirement for founders to realize how much better they can be made by having a consigliere.
I 100% agree with you. I work with Carol Robin in a very similar way.
Who's and awesome.
She
and
is
who
awesome.
Was my teacher in school, grad
and,
school.
And mine at a touchy-feely class at Stanford Business School, sadly no longer there. But now working with a bunch of startups, CEOs and venture capitalists and other people in the industry, so continuing to do a great work. So, you know, I think one of the things that you mentioned is very true. A lot of the cause of dysfunction in organizations is when, in many instances, the founder or the CEO is interpreted in a way that's different than what they intended. Oftentimes, that is because the things that make you successful, your advantages early in the company, you know, when amplified, and certainly when amplified by the success of the company, can start to cause some of those exactly, you know, some of these problems. Almost as though your greatest strengths can become areas for misinterpretation or weakness as the company grows. Do you have any sort of thoughts or examples of, you know, how that has happened at Bonobos?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can think of two traits that in the early years of Bonobos enabled me to be really successful that became profound weaknesses and frankly threats to the company and the organization as things progressed. One is shiny new object syndrome, and the other one is
for amen to that.
Yeah.
I remember we had a lot of conversations about like
we did, and I think, you know, you're driven to distraction by the world to become a founder. You don't want to take a job because you don't find anything compelling about working elsewhere. You want to make something new and put something new in the world, and then you wake up one day and you've actually put something new in the world. In our case, an internet-driven pants company that was really disruptive, both in terms of the way that we were delivering a better fit and better service, and then the internet-driven model by which we were showing how brands, I believe, will be built, you know, going forward. And you wake up one day 3 years in and that's working, or maybe 5 years in, and you're actually bored by what the company does because you've kind of gotten it off the ground. And there's tremendous work still to be done to scaling that and growing that and evolving that. And that work isn't that intellectually interesting to you. And so what you do in that scenario is you frequently start dreaming up what the next thing is that the company should do. And sometimes that's great because the company's ready for it. But frequently, I think the company's not ready because 5 years is a long time in your life. And for many founders, it's the longest time they've spent doing anything. But it's actually not that long in the life of a company, right? And you could make a good argument that it takes 10 years to really build the strong foundation for a company. That happens to be an eternity in the life of someone who likes to come up with new ideas and probably every 3 months has got something new that they want to do. And so repeatedly, starting in year five, once we'd really established Bonobos, we'd invented the guide shop model, you know, we had our core inventions of a better fitting pant, an internet-driven brand, and a next generation retail store. Those inventions were behind us and we just needed to scale it. And so then I started to get excited about two things: building a technology platform to power not just the Bonobos brand, but ultimately other brands, and then creating some of those other brands in-house. We ended up launching a women's brand and a men's golf brand. And those two things, the technology platform and the multi-brand strategy, nearly sank the company because they were distractions to what we needed to do at that time, which is to build, just make Bonobos great. And if you have a cash flow negative core business, adding other cash flow negative initiatives only distorts resources away from the main endeavor, and it distracts people at the company who need to be relentlessly focused on what you're currently doing. And so that's a great example of where the trait that led you to found the company becomes a threat to the company just a half decade later. The second example I would give...
And before we go into the second example, I'll just note that you ended up spinning off two of those initiatives into separate companies, the technology platform and Air, the women's business, and then you folded the golf label back into Bonobo's core.
Yeah. It was funny. It took some distance. You know, in the summer of 2015, we hired an outside CEO. I tried to become the chairman of the business. That didn't work out. And some 90 days later, I came back in. But I was in China trying to recruit my then girlfriend to return to the United States and now wife, which was successful. So there was something that worked that summer. It was sort of my go see about a girl moment. If you remember that amazing scene with Robin Williams and Matt Damon in Good Will Hunting.
It's definitely the rom-com finale right there.
It is. And what's interesting is the benefit of that summer was I got to get some objective distance from the company. And from afar, what I saw was, I asked myself the following question: what the heck am I doing, or was I doing, with these other concepts that were derivative of the core but weren't in the core of the business? And so it's kind of strange that I had to, it took the distance of being the chairman of the company to see clearly the thing that Brian Wolf had been telling me for 3 years, which is that these distractions are just that, they're jeopardizing the core endeavor of the company. It's a bit sad to me that it took that, but once I came back and realized that I had made an error, it was time to divest those things and to say, you know what, I made a mistake. Let's get these out of the company and let's focus. And I think that was what really enabled us to turn the corner to profitability.
Yeah.
You know, as a pretty quick follow-up to divesting those non-core assets.
Absolutely. And the second one?
The second one I'll call Golden Child Syndrome, which is that as a founding CEO, ideally you're good at building relationships, both in recruiting people and then the way that you build bonds quickly to galvanize. And part of that is about leadership of the group, which is about, you know, getting up in front of the team and the quick conversations you're having in the hallways. And part of that is really getting to know the human beings behind the executives who work for you. And in some cases, a wider circle of kind of cultural carriers at the company where you really want to get to know the human being beyond the employee. And that's something I learned from my mom, an immigrant from India who ended up being the leader of an ultrasound group for 20 years. And she used to be on the phone at night with her employees, taking on their personal problems, talking to them about their kids, about their marriages, and really caring for the human being. And I think that for me comes naturally, and it's something where I'm just curious about people and I want to learn about them and ask probing questions. The problem with that is that you can build such a interpersonally close relationship that you start to not be neutral about the company. You know, your loyalty is to the mission of the company, not to any individual in it. And what would happen is that our executives would see that someone new would come in. They don't have any of the legacy baggage that the people who've been around have. And so it would quickly come to pass that I would develop this really fast friendship with someone who was new, to the chagrin of the people who've been here for a while, being like, oh, there he goes again, right? Here's this new person who's like, you know, the savior for the company. And we've never had a, you know, a head of marketing or a head of technology before. And Andy's really excited about that. And that's actually a really pernicious thing to do as a leader, because it destabilizes the equality that you need amongst all the different tribes and therefore all the different leaders at your company. It upsets that. It actually confers too much influence on someone new who themselves is then set up as a little bit of a target of the company because they're the subject of this close relationship. And it frequently vaunts their self-confidence and brings them to a place of feeling more self-important than they should, when what they really need to do with the rest of the team is earn the respect. And so it took some pattern recognition for me for a while to realize, actually, you know, step back and take 12 to 18 months to let someone prove themselves, rather than kind of jumping in with this golden child syndrome and actually setting them up for failure.
So the company was acquired by Walmart last year. Now you're in charge of all of the vertical brands, now three.
Mm-hmm.
So Bonobos.
Bonobos, ModCloth, and then we just launched this week a digitally native mattress and bedding brand called Allswell.
And what's the plan going forward?
You know, our belief is that what's going to happen in e-commerce is a little bit like what Netflix did in video content, which is, as third-party brands that are available everywhere becomes a increasingly commoditized, low-margin business. Actually, it already is, and it's only getting more competitive with the rise of a number of players in the industry who are becoming just massive competitors, competing down, you know, the marginal price of these different brands. You're going to need something proprietary to play offense and to give people a reason to come to your platforms. And at Walmart, the strategy that Mark Lurie and I aligned on is that probably takes a portfolio of some 30 to 40 brands to create a tipping point where people want to come to you. And as we think about the urban millennial customer of the future, we think the digitally native brands that are out there, you know, and that whole ecosystem that Bonobos has helped pioneered, are the kinds of really high net promoter score, cult of consumer passion brands that over time are going to become the core way that millennials like to transact when they're transacting in narrow and deep categories. And funnily enough, this was the idea that we had earlier while at Bonobos that wasn't going to make sense on Bonobos' balance sheet. But now that we work for the Fortune 1 company, the largest company in the world, we have got the power to go and assemble that portfolio. So I call it the LVMH of digital brands. And that, more than anything, was the reason why we decided to sell the brand to Walmart.
Well, so far, so good. It seems like the business has continued to do very well under Walmart's umbrella. Customers continue to be happy. I was just poking around looking at some of the new fabrics for some of the shirts that are coming out, and I actually quite looking forward to buying some of those. So congratulations, and it's just great to catch up with you. It's been far too long.
Thank you, Jeremy. Great to see you. And of course, thanks for backing us before anyone else did.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks.
This podcast is produced by Lightspeed Venture Partners. For more details on this episode, head over to tbtpodcast.com. Thanks for listening.